Good afternoon. I'm Gary Island from the King & Spalding Law Firm in Houston, and despite the weather reports you've heard up here last night and today, it was a fairly easy commute from Houston this morning. You leave on time about 7:30, and you arrive at Baltimore about 11:30 on time, and you catch a cab over here, and the parkway is absolutely empty because people have taken off. And you drive up to the hotel. So it's a fairly easy commute today, and I understand, unfortunately, that a number of attendees had different experiences yesterday afternoon trying to arrive in the midst of the storm. So again, you're here. Enjoy your time in D.C. The topic this afternoon is Clinical Research Enforcement Initiatives and False Claims Act Update, and the real point here is to try to pick some of those enforcement initiatives that are more relevant to academic medical centers than others. I give another session in a couple of weeks at the AHLA Hospitals and Health Systems Program, which is a more generic False Claims Act and enforcement update, and thank goodness they've given me a little more time that they've allowed it here. But what I've done is try to go through and pick out some current developments. Certainly this is not an exhaustive survey, but to hit a few of those that really are important to academic medical centers. And we're going to look at the Compliance and Enforcement Authority that was contained in the FERA and in the PPAC legislation, look at some of the enforcement actions and key TAM litigations that have been targeted at academic medical centers, look at clinical research compliance risk and initiatives, and again, some of the internal compliance activities that should be underway. First, looking at the kind of FERA and the PPACA with respect to amendments that have been made to the False Claims Act specifically and with respect to some of the other enforcement authorities that were contained within that legislation. Importantly, both pieces of legislation provided increased funding for enforcement activities. But nevertheless, the False Claims Act continues to be kind of the vehicle of choice. Now, sometimes the choice is made by the Department of Justice. Sometimes it's made by a whistleblower filing a key TAM litigation. But nevertheless, there has been a great escalation in activities in the last few years under the False Claims Act and specifically targeted at healthcare industry clients. During fiscal year 2010, 2.5 of the 4.6 billion False Claims Act recovery were healthcare. Now, when you start getting into billions of dollars, obviously some of those are the pharmaceutical industry, off-label use and the like, but nevertheless, significant pressure with respect to increasing enforcement activities. With the increased funding, DOJ and the other enforcement agencies certainly announced the HEAT program, the Healthcare Fraud Prevention and Enforcement Action Team, initially rolled out in a few cities such as Miami and Detroit, Houston, and a few other places. But even though they're making great strides, it's hard to satisfy everyone. Senator Grassley recently sent a letter to Secretary Sebulis and Attorney General Holder back in December, basically quizzing DOJ and DHHS whether they were using the increased funding wisely, officially, and promptly to combat healthcare fraud. And many of you know that Senator Grassley is renowned for his information and document requests that he sends out to various providers. Well, the Secretary and the Attorney General were also the recipient of that type of document and information request to try to bring to light kind of how effectively the agencies have been using the increased funding. And so obviously you have that type of oversight, and you're going to see continued evolution of some of the enforcement initiatives. The key TAM relators, and one of the issues that has been important with respect to key TAM relators and included within the legislation has to do with a situation, a subset of key TAM relators, and that are those that have allegations that are already or in whole or in part within the public domain. Obviously, when a False Claims Act is filed by a key TAM relator, They must file the complaint under seal. They have given advance notice to the local U.S. Attorney's Office or Department of Justice. It's filed under seal. The DOJ is given a period of time to do their own internal investigation. And in prior periods, the courts have been very, very liberal with providing Department of Justice extensions of time for their investigations. But we're seeing a dramatic reduction in that. I am involved in one case down in South Florida in which the judge, after 1 year, said, that's it, no more extensions. And when the DOJ was not ready to make an intervention decision, immediately unsealed the case, and now it's being pursued by the Relators Council. So again, the old issues back, for example, from the cardiology device cases that began in 1994 and were not resolved to 2002 and really were not unsealed to 2000, those things are a day of the past. The courts are making these move very quickly. But the Department of Justice has to decide to intervene, and if they do not intervene, or if they decline to intervene at this time, as number are doing, then the Relators Council can continue to proceed with the case. Now, there is one little factor here, and that is the public disclosure bar, and that is if the allegations contained within the False Claims Act complaint were the subject of prior public disclosure, then even in 1986, Congress was convinced that there should be a jurisdictional bar to preclude the case from proceeding unless it could be shown that the relator was an original source of that information. And note that in 1986, it really was a jurisdictional bar. After the PPACA changes, it's no longer stated in terms of a jurisdictional bar. In your materials, you'll see in just a moment a red line. But since it's no longer a jurisdictional bar, jurisdictional bars bar the federal court from having jurisdiction. So it can be raised at any time during the course of the litigation. And frankly, if the defendants did not raise it, the court could have had on their own motion have raised a jurisdictional bar. Now with the changes, it's no longer a jurisdictional bar, and so it's going to require defendants, healthcare providers, and others to be much more vigilant in identifying original source issues and raising those in their answer or their positive motion, or they're likely to have that defense waived. What the Congress did with respect to public disclosure bar is to basically indicate that the court may dismiss a claim unless opposed by the government. Now, stop there for a moment. In the past, it was a jurisdictional bar, and unless the predicate and the exceptions to the jurisdictional bar were met, the case was out of here. Now, they may not meet some of the other predicates that are contained in this provision, but the government can object to a proposed dismissal of the case based upon public disclosure. And if they do that, if they feel that the relator can nevertheless add significant information to prosecuting the case. So again, that's one step. The government now can object to dismissal of the action. The second change you will note in a number of these subsections, the word federal has been inserted. So with respect to public disclosures that related to a prior criminal, civil, or administrative hearing, in the past we used to be able to look to see whether there was some type of administrative action at the state level, at the local level, or even at the federal level. Now, with respect to those, it has to be federal level only will constitute public disclosure for purposes of the False Claims Act. And the same thing with respect to a government accountability office or other federal report, hearing, or audit. It's only federal reports and audits that can trigger the public disclosure bar. Interestingly, they have made no change in the news media. And obviously, in various of the urban markets around the country. You have some very active investigative reporters at TV stations and the like that are taking cause celebs with respect to various academic medical centers and deliveries of health care that involve resident care and others. There, if there is something that is publicly disclosed and it later becomes the subject matter of a False Claims Act, it's still a candidate to be dismissed under public disclosure bar. Interestingly, over the years, I've had clients when they're, especially just in routine type of compliance discussions, and they have a significant overpayment exposure. You know, their one question is, how do we cut off potential False Claims Act liabilities? Does simply disclosure and repayment give rise to cutting those off? When we had to tell them, it reduces the risk, but it doesn't eliminate, because you do have the possibility of someone filing a False Claims Act lawsuit based upon being an original source. But one thing you could do is every time you make a disclosure, every time you make a refund, issue a press release. If the press release is picked up, published in the newspaper, at least you have the predicate for a public disclosure bar. I will say that I have not had many clients take me up on that that suggestion, but nevertheless, it's still a valid observation that you can, in the realm of your normal compliance mentality, you're above board, you're transparent, and so if you're going to make the disclosure and the repayment, announce it. And announce it in that context. If it's picked up by the news media, more power to you. The other item is there's a slight modification of what type of information the individual who wants to be the original source must have. In the past, it was stated that they must have direct and independent knowledge of the activity. Now that has been slightly modified, and it says down to number two, knowledge that is independent of and materially adds to the publicly disclosed allegations or transactions. There really hasn't been any litigation yet that can decide whether that is a material change in the knowledge standard, but nevertheless, at least superficially, there is. But nevertheless, in order to be an original source for something that has been the subject of a criminal investigation, for example, a federal hearing, or news media disclosures, there's now two branches of it. One, that the individual either prior to the public disclosure had voluntarily disclosed that to the government, or two, that person not only has knowledge that will materially add, but has voluntarily provided the information to the government before filing an action under this section. So still, there must be discussions with the government either prior to the public disclosure or prior to filing the QTAM action. So some changes there. Now, with respect to the application of the public disclosure bar, there's an interesting case that was decided just this past November dealing with Goldberg v. Rush Medical Center because, again, this is under the pre-PPAC rule. But nevertheless, you know, the allegations were made in that the medical center had violated the False Claims Act by improperly billing for teaching physician services. The physicians had not properly supervised residents to the level that would be required to bill. The court in this case basically took judicial notice based upon what was submitted with motions for summary judgment and to dismiss, and basically concluded that the PATH audits, remember PATH audits, some of us like to say it's a thing of the past. They began in about 1995, 1996. They continued into the early 2000, 2001, 2002. And there were a series of audits by the OIG and also some under auspices of local U.S. attorney's offices in which they were analyzing the physicians at teaching hospital compliance with the Medicare, used to be called IL-372, but the teaching physician regulations. And basically, this judge held that those PATH audits, even though they were sometime distant in the past, and even though they didn't specifically state that there had been a PATH audit at Rush University Medical Center, nevertheless, dismissed it, saying that they could not meet the original source requirement, and hence the public disclosure bar was activated. That's interesting because this case will certainly be picked up and cited any time that there is some type of piggyback QI-TAM case alleging violations of the Medicare teaching physician rules. Other things that FARA did was to expand the definition of claim, and if you read through that language, and I'll not take time to do that here, but by and large, this certainly now clarifies that just because payment may come through a Medicare contractor, the folks we used to call Medicare intermediaries, Medicare carriers, the ones that actually process the claims and pay, is not a defense. The payment is still being made on behalf of the federal government and can give rise to False Claims Act liability. Probably, at least from an ongoing basis, what I say here, probably the single most significant development for the healthcare is the obligation to report identified overpayment to make repayment, because the law, both the FARA and then some clarification with PPAC, clarifies that the retention of an overpayment can itself give rise to False Claims Act liability. And by and large, that was accomplished first in FARA, which set forth new definitions within the False Claims Act for, quote, an obligation. And part of the obligation would be an established duty, whether or not fixed, arising from the retention of any overpayment. Now, for many years in Social Security Act, the Medicare Act, there's already under civil monetary penalties, et cetera, a provision that is kind of the Medicare obligation to refund overpayment. But here you have now with FARA basically the repayment of such an overpayment obligation is within the ambit of the statute such that there is clear False Claims Act liability for failure to report and to refund. Now, the FARA legislative history was very specific that that Congress was not intending to play gotcha. They weren't going to say in the situation where there are routine reconciliation process that occur over time. For example, teaching hospitals still file Medicare and Medicaid cost reports. So those are done on an annual basis, a period of time after the end of the fiscal year. So as long as those things would have been normally reported during the course of the cost reporting process and repaid as part of the settlement of the cost report, that was not intended to give liability. Although, on the other hand, the agencies also quickly, or the Congress quickly said, on the other hand, if there is a scheme to increase interim payments, with the intent to basically have an interest-free loan for a period of time and to refund, they could still pursue that. But that kind of rarely would happen in at least academic medical center environment. The other is just routine grant reporting. Grant reportings have periodic financial reporting obligations, and if there is reconciliations of overpayments, that's not going to give rise to liability under this section, new section of the False Claims Act. What the PPAC did was put a little more teeth on the bone here. Basically, what they said was that if there is an overpayment repayment obligation, the recipient or the holder of that must report and return the overpayment within 60 days of identifying the existence of that overpayment. Now, obviously, it doesn't really provide a lot of information as to what it means by reporting. Obviously, returning, we have an idea what that means. You have to repay the obligation, but they don't provide any guidance as what is the format of repay. We know from compliance activities that clients routinely, when they identify various types of overpayments, just handle it through the claim submission process. They void the prior claim and resubmit new claims. And here, you know, part of the issue is if you do that, that certainly should satisfy your obligation to repay, but have you reported? And so I actually have my clients many times when I say, go into the screen. Is there any type of comment field? Can you put a comment in there as to why you're doing this? And if so, fill it out, give notice, copy the screen, keep it where you file. But nevertheless, you would have report. Now, obviously, under more significant types of overpayments and potential disclosures, you're going to be working with the enforcement agencies, whether it's with CMS for Stark, whether it's OIG for anti-kickback, or whether it's with the Department of Justice for other types of situations, and you will work with them. And at least in some situations, we've even had the DOJ to quickly send us a letter on behalf of our client saying that during the pendency of their review, please do not repay. One of them says, place the monies in escrow and hold until we complete our investigation. So I think there you've at least papered it so that there's no continuing responsibility under the False Claims Act because you're acting upon instruction from the DOJ with respect to that issue. But again, the key is you have 60 days to report and to return the overpayment. The effective date of PPAC was March 23, so that meant that for those that had been identified as of that date, you know, reports had been due on May 22nd. From my contacts within some of the enforcement agencies, they did not mention that they had a rush of disclosures on May 22. But nevertheless, that is a continuing, ongoing overpayment reporting obligation. From an academic medical center standpoint, can you retain funds during the reconciliation period? And the answer is certainly on a cost report concept, on routine grant reporting, the answer is yes, as long as you make sure it's included within the next routine reconciliation process. How quickly must one act? And here the real question is, when is an overpayment considered identified? Well, the statute doesn't really address when it's considered identified, so I suggest going back and look at the OIG provider self-disclosure protocol. Even there, it had suggested that there would be disclosure within 60 days of determining that credible evidence of an overpayment existed. Now, that gives you the opportunity to review. I mean, if you have the possibility that there's an overpayment, that is not an identified overpayment as of yet. So you can do due diligence and to determine whether, in fact, an overpayment exists. But once that decision has been made, you've identified the overpayment, and the 60-day rule begins to come into play. Well, let's move to, actually, I'm going to mention another item in PPAC right here. Since it's brand new this week, but part of the PPAC had provisions that, among other things, allowed for offsets, recoupments, and suspension of payments when there is a credible allegation of fraud. The new rules, final rules for that provision were released by HHSC CMS this past Monday. They have not yet been published in the Federal Register, but you can access those online, and they do give specific authority to the Medicare contractors and others to withhold, suspend payments based upon credible allegations of fraud. It doesn't provide a lot of detail as to what is a credible allegation of fraud. It does use that as a defined term, but basically says if there are reasonable indicia of fraud, that is satisfactory to permit disclosure. That goes into a place, forget the actual date, sometime in March this year is the effective date. You'll want to take a look at it. Another aspect mentioned in that final rule, but not included within the final rule, was the PPAC provisions that did two things. One, it mandated mandatory compliance programs for nursing homes. It also gave the agencies the authority to mandate mandatory compliance programs for other providers and suppliers. There had been in the original proposed rule solicitation of comments. In this final rule, the agencies basically announced that they're carving that out, and that will be the subject of a separate rulemaking process to dictate the requirements of mandatory compliance programs for nursing homes, and then what are the elements of mandatory compliance and to what other providers and suppliers that might be applied to in the future. So do keep your eyes open. Again, that was discussed in the preamble to the rulemaking that was just issued Monday of this week. Before we get into some of the enforcement actions that specifically relate to clinical research, I thought you ought to at least see some of the False Claims Act cases that have come out recently dealing with academic medical centers. One is LSU Health Services Science Center Shreveport. I mentioned path audits just a moment ago. Well, the path concept is not dead. There are still periodic QTAM whistleblower copycat path lawsuits. This one was settled back in 2009 for $706,000. I was not involved in this one, but involved in others that are very similar to this one. That is, frankly, just a cost of defense. That's a cost of litigation settlement from the university standpoint. Frankie, you look at this, you note that that says paid $706,000 denied liability. And they did because, frankly, this is LSU's part of the state of Louisiana. It probably had a very strong Stevens Supreme Court defense that False Claims Act liability cannot be appended to a state institution. And even though you have that Stevens decision from back in 2001, that doesn't protect even a state academic medical center from just routine overpayment liability. So they would still have routine overpayment, and certainly it doesn't stop them from the cost of defense from just a government investigation. So again, not certain as to how many of those elements gave rise to the decision to pay, but $706,000 in a full-blown False Claims Act litigation with electronic discovery and the like probably is a pretty cheap bargain. That's hard to say when I remember earlier in my career, the objective many times was to just get to a six-figure number. And now that's even seven times six figures is a relatively modest type of settlement. Kaiser also had a kind of path look-alike audit or look-alike QTAM case filed in 2009, settled in that case a bit higher, $3.75 million. Now, obviously, they would not have had the Stevens False Claims Act defense that you cannot apply false claims against the state. Other recent kind of developments, I put this one in here, Detroit Medical Center, because it's affiliated with Wayne State and others up in Detroit. They were recently sold to the Vanguard system out of Nashville during the course of the due diligence. There were a number of potentially improper financial relationships with referring physicians identified. Those are office leases, medical directors, and other agreements with gap arrangements. They didn't always routinely get the renewal contract signed as of the termination of the term of the original contract. And so they had gap leases, and many times they went back and filled those in, but not entirely. And if you have a financial arrangement with physicians and it's not covered by a written contract, you're going to have potential Stark Law liability, if not also anti-kickback liability. They also had what they referred to as excess business courtesies. Physicians were on their medical staff, received tickets to some of the pro athletic events in the Detroit area. And the value of those tickets are greater than the $355 allowance that is currently permitted under some of the OIG standards. So nevertheless, they also had some physician E&M coding issues. Interestingly here, this transaction was originally scheduled to close by the end of October. Once these issues were identified and recognized, it went to a self-disclosure process. That was pushed back to December, but there were other reasons that it could not go beyond. Now, these were kind of one of the first self-disclosures involving suspect financial arrangements after CMS published their self-disclosure protocol in September. Nevertheless, ultimately, this was handled through the Department of Justice, because they were able to marshal all of the troops, CMS for Stark, the OIG for anti-kickback and other types of sanctions under civil monetary penalties, and then obviously the DOJ itself for False Claims Act exposure. And ultimately, it was resolved for the repayment of $30 million with no imposition of a CIA or CCA. And a part of the reason for that was that Vanguard basically had and were able to demonstrate that they had effective compliance programs in place that would be immediately overlaid over top of the old Detroit Medical Center activities. Is there a question? That was more the effect of an ability to pay analysis. If you, I mean, you can go back and you can look at publicity in Detroit area for the last 3 to 5 years. Detroit Medical Center has been a marginal financially performing institution that was on the brink of bankruptcy a number of times. Yes. Had not heard that. The comment was that at least there had been reports that there have been possibly several dozen subpoenas issued to some of the physicians that were identified on the exhibits to the settlement agreement. And frankly, you know, that was a risk, you know, from both further government investigations, also opportunistic QI-TAM whistleblower lawsuits, when as part of the settlement they had to identify the actual physicians who DMC had these suspect financial arrangements with, and they were identified on exhibits to the settlement agreement. Had not heard that. That'll be interesting to follow up with. Actually, if you're interested in this type of settlement, there's actually another case that is similar that was about 2 years earlier out of Illinois called Condell, C-O-N-D-E-L-L. It was also a settlement that was kind of predicated within the environment of due diligence with respect to a sell purchase transaction. The difference there is the local U.S. Attorney's Office was the controlling driving factor behind the settlement as opposed to DOJ-DC. And again, there's other sessions that deal with conflict of interest, but I just noted back in December, about the time that these outlines were due, that the Senate Finance Committee had issued another statement that they were looking at a Maryland cardiologist accused of implanting nearly 600 unnecessary stents, and suggesting that there may be a causal relationship between the cardiologist and the manufacturer of the stents in question, and pointed out that Medicare paid $3.8 million. So there's going to continue to be a lot of focus upon conflict of interest, and then especially if it goes just beyond conflict of interest and it really can be shown to have an impact upon medical necessity of the procedure that is delivered. And along that vein, there are two active investigations that I want to mention. One began in Western District of New York with the QI-TAM case against the Coffine company that basically alleging that hospitals had been billing for the kyphoplasty procedure, which is a procedure to relieve some degenerative activity within the spinal column, and that causes significant pain, and they can do this procedure and put some cement and relieve some of the pressure that causes the pain. And by and large, for the first number of years, these were routinely done on an inpatient basis. And there's even some of the Medicare rules and also some of the other guidance that would have supported that. But the allegations were that this could have been successfully done on an outpatient basis, would have cost significantly less to the Medicare program, and maybe even more clinically appropriate. Nevertheless, there have been about 24, 25 hospitals that have settled as opposed to continuing to defend the kyphoplasty investigation. I'm aware of at least one, if not more, copycat QI-TAM cases elsewhere in the country that folks have raised allegations of improper billing for kyphoplasty as inpatient versus outpatient. And a number of those are academic medical centers that have been caught up within the scope of this. Another ongoing investigation is the implantable cardiac defibrillators here, basically suggesting that providers were providing the services and billing Medicare for ICDs when they did not, in certain circumstances, meet the Medicare coverage decision, the Medicare coverage guidance for implantable ICDs. You will need to go take a look at the actual Medicare coverage decision on this, but nevertheless, there are some routine requirements. For example, that you cannot have this performed in the routine cases within about 40 days of a heart attack, or you cannot have it within a certain period of time after some other type of angioplasty or CABG procedure. Nevertheless, many of these were provided earlier than those time parameters, and now the Department of Justice is reviewing these and determining whether or not there were any improper submission of claims. When these first rolled out back in early 2010, the first wave of hospitals received civil investigative demands. The second and third waves have come out. The third wave came out sometime end of November 2010, and there they were using a more informal cooperative approach, basically just a letter to the hospital or the academic medical center asking them to engage in discussions with the DOJ to facilitate a review and discussion of any questioned ICD-9 claims. Nevertheless, there's a lot of background here, and if you have one of these, you need to make sure you get good, competent assistance, both from the standpoint of legal and clinical understanding of those with respect to reviewing the propriety of the ICD-9 implants. I mentioned off-label use, and again, this is covered in other contexts, but again, there have been a whole series of enforcement actions with respect to off-label use, and since off-label use many times does occur in academic medical centers, should be aware that even though the focus have been on the pharmaceutical companies, the physicians and even providers are not necessarily immune from potential liability here. That's some of the kind of selected False Claims Act update and some of the enforcement initiatives. I want to cover in the remainder of the time just some of the specific issues with respect to clinical research, because those are extremely important, and we're going to cover these fairly quick. Keep in mind that it's always helpful to take a look at the OIG work plan. And if you look at the 2011 work plan, these are just four items that I picked off. There's probably another 10 items I could have put on a second and a third slide, and I'll mention some of those as we go forward. But they're review college and university compliance with select cost principles under A21, review colleges and university recharge centers compliance with cost rate schedules, review data and clinical trials monitoring by the DSMB, analyze scope of grantee compliance with NH policies of multi-site clinical trials. A whole host of these are identified, and again, like I said, I could have put another couple of slides together with other bullet points. Now, keep in mind that as we go through and look at some of these settlements, that I will point out that this issue is still on the 2011 work plan. Doesn't mean that it's going to necessarily be an active investigation. It's some of these, they come back in and say, we want to go back in and double check and see whether or not the industry got it 5 years ago. We reported these settlements that we gave with the background. Hopefully the industry has learned from that and has taken steps from a compliance standpoint to reduce the risk. So some of this may be just a validation review, but nevertheless, they're on the OIG work plan. There also was a November 2009 OIG report, and this really had to do with financial interest and disclosures, and even back there the OIG said in 2009 that grantee institutions do not routinely verify information submitted by researchers. obviously there has to be greater and greater attention to detail on financial conflicts of interest, and there's separate sessions in this program that'll be addressing those. Again, why is clinical research compliance? Obviously, there's significant risk to the institution, diminution of the institution's reputation, loss of funding, risk of fines and penalties, and even shutdown of research opportunities. And obviously also compliance risk to individuals, loss of PI status, debarment, criminal or civil sanctions. Now, when we start talking about clinical research, there are a whole host of issues from billing to grant management that have to be analyzed. But one still starts back with the CMS clinical research policy that was first product of the Clinton-era executive memo published back in June 7, 2000. And this timeline kind of walks you through the evolution of that through some of the January 7, 2009 MedLearn materials that have been published trying to clarify some of the rules. There's also another session here that has talked about Medicare secondary payer and how that impacts. So I've got a couple of slides on that, but I'm going to kind of breeze through those and by and large get to the punchline, which is that if the clinical trial sponsors routinely pays, they will have both a reporting obligation and Medicare will deem that they are the primary payer. If the Medicare, the sponsor never makes payment for research-related industry, Medicare will say that those are some of the routine costs associated with clinical research and will likely be the primary payer. But go back and take a look at some of the earlier slides. It has the detail, and as I said, there's a separate section here that Holly Lutz and others were involved in that gave you quite a bit of detail on Medicare secondary payer, so I don't want to be too repetitive in this session. When you look at research compliance, still probably the best starting point is the 2005 OIG Draft Compliance Program Guidance for Clinical Research. Now, interestingly, that I thought it was draft. The OIG had basically solicited comments from the industry, and as they'd done in other contexts, I'm sure would have ultimately had a final draft. But there was at least some discussion among a multi-agency group that felt that there should be a multi-agency initiative and not just HHS-OIG that dealt with clinical research compliance. And as a result, the OIG withdrew their 2005 draft compliance program guidance, and that was then turned over to the National Science and Technology Council to expand upon it. Unfortunately, that seems to have just died from inactivity. In talking to OIG contacts, they've said they had at least two meetings over there trying to re-energize the process, but it has not been re-energized, and unless there is a swell of demand from the industry or elsewhere, there likely will not be any compliance program guidance in the near future dealing with clinical research. Nevertheless, it's important to take a look at it because it does identify some of the risk areas. And obviously the important thing is synchronizing with Medicare rules. And part of the first one is just how do you apply the national coverage determinations with respect to clinical research. And here's this Rush University Medical Center settlement back in 2005 in which the allegations were, and actually more than allegations, they self-disclosed that they had improperly billed both the sponsor and Medicare for $670,000 in physician and hospital cancer research activities. They had failed to synchronize to see kind of which one is responsible, and again, Medicare, under Medicare secondary liability, would not pay if there is another source of payment for those services. As a result, there was a $1 million settlement. The corrective actions including not only establishing the Research and Clinical Trials Administrative Office, but requiring a coverage analysis for clinical trials. For the next few years, Rush was held up as kind of the example of someone that had put together coverage analysis, and obviously now those have been expanded upon in probably many of your client institutions with respect to making sure that there's proper billing in the context of clinical research. Also, there was a settlement from University of Alabama, again, allegations billed Medicare for clinical research programs that were also billed to the sponsor. Now, as I throw a number of these settlements up here, keep in mind that many times these are the result of a QI-TAM action, and there are a laundry list of allegations. It may not be just one. There may be six or seven or eight different allegations. I've tried to identify these under some headings, but you'll see that there is some repetition that some of these institutions and some of these settlements get mentioned under different categories. Another area is failure to completely report support from other sources. Here it's really important from the OIG perspective and even from the NIH and others that if there is the possibility of support from other sources, that be reported in the context of the grant application. And you can find a case that's over 10 years old now, but out of the Third Circuit, in which a medical researcher in the University of Pittsburgh were subject to False Claims Act penalties for failure to disclose other sources of research support on the NIH grant applications. So obviously important to make sure we disclose other sources of support. Another element identified in the 2005 compliance guidance, allocating charges among various award projects and inappropriate activities, end-of-year transfers, PIs on different research projects banking or trading award funds among themselves, mischarging federal grants, inflating research grant cost, differentiating direct cost versus indirect cost. Let me stop here. There is still, on the 2011 OIG work plan, another category, another item in which they are trying to identify whether or not indirect costs are being properly accounted. There they're suggesting that there are, under some limited circumstances, the ability to directly allocate certain types of indirect costs to a specific grant if that grant subject requires extensive additional administrative cost. But they're concerned that they may be overstepping the boundary and they may not qualify for the direct assignment of indirect cost, and there should only be just kind of the one overlay through the normal step down of indirect cost. Again, cost transfers and the like. You look at the Institute for Cancer Prevention, $2.3 million settlement, and the former CFO pled guilty to obstruction of justice for repeating lying to federal agents concerning false statements. University of Chicago, this was not a settlement. This was an OIG audit, Office of Audit Services report, basically finding that there were after-the-fact reallocation of cost, that proper procedures for cost transfers were not followed. There was no fine assessed because this was, again, Office of Audit Services, not Office of Investigation, that was involved here. The Mayo, back in 2005, had a QI-TAM Act settlement, $6.5 million, improper cost transfers, improperly charged grant for cost unrelated to the research. And again, anytime you have those, it's easy for the government to allege their accounting system was unable to monitor and properly manage the grants. So $6.5 million. Harvard Beth Israel also had, in this case, improper billing for grants over a five-year period. Salaries inappropriately paid for researchers who do not work on the grant. Charging salaries in excess of budgeted amount. And also additional expense for researchers who's not eligible. So again, you have to be extremely careful, and this was a $2.4 million. Yale University, again, spent down remaining grant funds near the expiration date. $7.6 million, half of that was punitive. And then just a laundry list of other cases in which there were settlements in which the improper allocation of cost, improper reporting of cost, were at least one or more of the allegations that gave rise to the settlement. Time and effort reporting. In the OIG work plan, it talks about a researcher separately reports three awards, that he spends 50% of his time on each of the three awards. Obviously, it's pretty hard to do that if you only have 100% of your time to spend 150% of it on three awards. Or the one that reports that 70% of researchers' time would be spent on an award, when 50% of the researchers' time would be spent on clinical responsibilities. Here, from a compliance standpoint, there's always issues with respect to time and effort reporting. And the reporting rules are that the institution must have time and effort systems that reasonably reflect the activity for which the employees are compensated, and must use independent external evaluations to ensure compliance from a clinical research standpoint. From a grant reporting, faculty and professional staff have to periodically do their time and effort reporting. But the key that has come up in compliance is the differences between clinical research time and effort reporting and Medicare time reporting and allocations. And here I spend quite a bit of time talking with some of our academic medical centers and teaching hospitals to really make sure they understand what are the objectives for each of those programs. From a research standpoint, you're trying to allocate individual physician effort and salary to specific grants. For Medicare, you're simply trying to identify the proportion of the aggregate faculty physician's compensation cost that can be claimed on the cost report as an allowable Part B teaching and administrative cost. Now, from a research standpoint, you do effort reporting. And there, you're looking at the total effort of the physician over a relevant period of time. For Medicare, typically it's time studies 2 weeks per quarter or 1 week per month, and all you're doing is taking a snapshot of what the physician is doing during those 2 weeks or 1 week time period. As a result, when one deals with total effort and the other is only looking at a snapshot, you can't expect that those are going to be identical. On the other hand, if there's material variances, I think from a compliance standpoint, you have to ask the question, why? And what a material variance, different clients have different rules for that. But nevertheless, if they meet their little trigger, they go out and say, well, was the physician really on clinic assignment for the 2 weeks they did the Medicare? And hence, that's why there's no research being reported during that two-week period. But on the overall research total effort reporting, 50% of time on research. So you have to, when you have significant variations, take a look at the variations between the two. There have been various reported decisions in which time and effort have been part of the elements. Here, just a laundry list, and as I said before, that's one of many allegations that were contained in some of these settlements. Take a look at East Carolina. It's not really healthcare. This actually was a National Library of Medicine grant. But there, among other things, they said that the time and effort reports were based on inconsistent methods. Some departments used percentage of time and efforts. Some used based upon hours worked, and even others. No requirement for timely submission of time and effort reports. No procedures to reconcile, and no procedure to compare time and effort reported to the approved funding levels. So, again, that's at least a good illustration. Again, that was another OIG audit as opposed to an investigation. Subrecipient monitoring, again, this was identified in 2005, and it, again, in a form, is on the 2011 work plan. And there have been a number of institutions tagged with settlements or audits dealing with subrecipient monitoring. Here's a reference to Boston University. Again, some resolutions that have occurred there. Indirect cost rates. Again, as I mentioned before, indirect cost rate in some portions on the 2011 OIG work plan, but here the University of Connecticut was alleged to have failed to utilize a proper basis for setting and updating a billing rate structure, and as a result did inappropriate cost sharing and matching. New York University falsely inflated indirect cost rate information, and these were the allegations, and with duplicate claims for the same utility cost, unallowable expenses for entertainment, and others. Which indirect cost rate applies? Well, one, if you look at OMB Circular A21 for colleges and university, says that the negotiated rate for F&A cost in effect at the time of the initial award continues throughout the life of the sponsored agreement for colleges and university. What is your academic medical center? Is it part of a college and a university, or is it a hospital? because that makes a difference. For hospitals, under OAS C3 guide, the indirect cost will vary year by year and F&A reporting period by reporting period. So you have to be very, very careful. A couple of years ago, I handled a self-disclosure to NIH whereby one academic medical center within a state university system, for some reason, had been designated by NIH as a hospital, while every other health component within the university system had been designated as a college and university. And there was a consultant that they came in and said, help us with respect to setting up our indirect cost rates on our grants. And they just assumed that the rate that was in place when the grant was awarded would apply throughout the term. And so that's how they entered it into their system. Well, as you might imagine, for some reason, the rate went down in a subsequent period. And while they continued to charge at the prior rate, they were overcharging for the indirect cost rate. In this one, we did self-disclose, and the NIH was willing to work with to go back in and to restate financial status reports and to repay the NIH for the overpayments that had occurred with interest. The good news, you didn't even get a press release out of that one, so. Internal compliance, again, I've already mentioned PPAC, mandatory compliance program right now, and Monday's final rule, the agencies have punted. They are going to issue a separate rulemaking on mandatory compliance, so watch for that and make sure you submit additional comments. As I've said before, the compliance is the three C's, comply, comply, comply. Obtain OIG CMS advisory opinions. Tomorrow there'll be a session that talks about an academic medical center receiving an OIG advisory opinion for a new multi-million dollar ambulatory care clinic among various components. Take a look at that. That's part of what you need to do from a compliance standpoint. Look back a few years ago and you'll see another one, another two, one that dealt with the donation of a medical office building from the teaching hospital to the medical school, and another that provided some subsidies from the teaching hospital to the medical school. Both of those felt, and they did receive, favorable OIG advisory opinions, and so that's certainly something that doesn't occur routinely, but if there's any questions, do seek and obtain, and provide the background information, and the OIG will be willing to listen with an open ear if you can provide the justification for it. Let me stop at this time. We're really out of time, but that's kind of just a quick overview of some of the important developments in False Claims Act, some of the enforcement initiatives, and some of the key areas for clinical research, research investigations and compliance. Any questions? Yes. Repeat that. Oh, I mean, the question really relates to, you know, with a lot of the both judicial challenges to the constitutionality of the health care reform with the various proposals from the Republicans and others to repeal. Are the fraud enforcement enhancement provisions segregable? The answer is yes, they are. Now, if you're just asking my personal opinion, I don't think there's going to ever be a such thing as a total 100% repeal of health care reform. There are actually some good items in there. There are some items that are questionable, and it can be improved. Now, as to how that's accomplished, you hope it's direct compromise and there's discussion. Who knows? It may be that someone feels that it's absolutely necessary to have a bill that simultaneously repeals and then substitutes, but then saves all the good stuff. So, I don't see anyone suggesting a repeal or a reduction in the healthcare fraud enforcement enhancements that were contained in any of the legislation. And that's something that crosses the aisle. You know, every Republican, every Democrat says we're against fraud, abuse, and waste.
Second quick question. You mentioned the 2005 PHS compliance guidance, and one of the that came out was that the
certainly, and that's part of why back in 2005, early 2006, it was withdrawn and was going to be assigned to a multi-agency initiative so you have input, because that was only one agency's initial interpretation. I really point to it because I think it's just a good list of potential red flags, not literal red flags, but potential red flags that it's worth including in your compliance program. And certainly, some of the interpretations were not square with how other agencies had interpreted those. But nevertheless, and some of these may just be the OIG saying, we're going to go back in and just do a random checkup, so to speak, to see what's changed with respect to these issues. But, you know, the overallocation of indirect cost is always a concern with respect to the reporting for grants. Anyone else? If not, enjoyed speaking with you this afternoon, and we'll see you at the reception shortly. Thank you.